Welcome to the Minnesota Military Radio Hour, where we bring you information about Minnesota's National Guard, military community, Beyond the Yellow Ribbon Program, and Department of Veteran Affairs. Your host is Tom Lyons, the founder and owner of Phalon Partners Limited, a Twin Cities merger and acquisition advisory firm. Tom is also a Vietnam veteran of the United States Air Force and a member of the VFW and American Legion. Now the host of Minnesota Military Radio Hour, Tom Lyons.
Welcome to the Minnesota Military Radio Hour. I'm Tom Lyons. On today's show, we talk to Doug Becky, the curator of the Minnesota Military Museum at Camp Ripley, and Eric Schmidt, a writer for the New York Times and author of Counterstrike, the Untold Story of America's Secret Campaign Against Al-Qaeda. But first, it's time for Generally Speaking, a weekly message from the Adjutant General of the Minnesota National Guard, Major General Rick Nash.
During this season of joy, thanksgiving, and celebration, I want to extend my warmest greetings, deep thanks, and best wishes to the brave men and women of the United States military and to their families. I know the holiday season is especially difficult for those service members who are unable to spend it with their loved ones. These defenders of freedom sacrifice their holidays so that fellow Americans can safely enjoy theirs. In doing so, they are part of a tradition that dates back to our nation's founding. On Christmas night, December 25th, 1776, General George Washington and his band of 2,400 men crossed the icy Delaware River, won victories against British and German troops, and stirred new hope in the struggle for freedom and liberty. Nearly 1 year after that famed crossing, the Continental Congress celebrated the hard-fought victory of our troops at Saratoga, New York, by proclaiming the first ever National Day of Thanksgiving. Today, more than 200 years later, thanks to the efforts and toughness of the men and women of the U.S. military, the cause of freedom and liberty endures. And though nothing can extinguish the pain of being away from family during this time, our service members can find comfort in knowing that the American people are forever indebted to them and grateful for their selflessness and commitment to America's security. This time of year calls on Minnesotans to reflect on and to give thanks for the freedoms and prosperity we enjoy. Of course, we can only do so because of those who put their lives on the line every day. The sailors, the soldiers, airmen, Marines, Coast Guardsmen, Merchant Marines, and our Department of Defense civilians who bear the repeated deployments, the hardships, and danger without fail and without complaint. Leading up to this holiday season, nothing has impressed me as much as the determination, resilience, and steadfastness of those who defend our nation. To our service members and their families this holiday season, along with Happy Hanukkah and Merry Christmas, I would add two words on behalf of millions of your fellow Minnesotans. Thank you.
Thank you, General Nash. For more information, please go to MinnesotaMilitaryRadioHour.com. On a recent trip to Camp Ripley in northern Minnesota, we had the opportunity to interview Doug Becky, the curator of the Minnesota Military Museum at Camp Ripley. And here's part of that interview. We're broadcasting from the Minnesota Military Museum at Camp Ripley near Little Falls, Minnesota. And I'm up here with Doug Becky, the curator of the Minnesota Military Museum. Welcome to the Minnesota Military Radio Hour.
Welcome to you coming here. I'm glad to have you here.
Nice to see you in person for a change.
Yes, that's right.
Can you tell us a little bit, the museum is open to the public when, and as they're driving past Camp Ripley, which most of us do,
sure.
When can they stop in and what can they see?
Sure. Well, from May 1st to October 1st, the museum's open 7 days a week. From 10 to 5, and this time of year we're open 2 days a week or by request. We have school groups and various groups that come in and they can request us to be open. But otherwise, we're open on Thursdays and Fridays from 9 to 4.
And you've got a school group in now. Where are they from?
Got a school group in from Crosby right now. That's pretty typical. We get a lot of school groups coming through. But one of our frustrations is that we have lots of people coming by, and they say, we've driven by the museum for years and years and years, and this is one of Minnesota's hidden treasures. It's a great museum. And we've never stopped here before. So we're open to the public, and please stop by.
Doug, why don't you show us around, and let's
sure.
See what you've got.
Well, there's a couple of pieces I'd like to show you, a couple of artillery pieces.
we're standing here by a light field gun that says 75 millimeter with caisson.
Right. Well, we have lots of outside displays here. We have lots of main battle tanks, aircraft, helicopters, all different kinds of things. But some of these pieces have a real important significance to Minnesota. This is a French 75 millimeter gun that was used in World War I. It was upgraded in the 1930s, taken to Camp Claiborne, Minnesota, and then left in the United States. After the units went to Northern Ireland, they got British 25-pound guns, and we've got one of those over here. They used those all through the North African campaign, came back, and then they got the 105 guns, which they continued to use all through World War II and then well after. And we regularly get veterans coming up here from World War II, and they're always thrilled to see these guns and remember their service through these guns.
So, Doug, we're outside the Minnesota Military Museum, and I see you've got a row of tanks.
Right.
Can you tell me about them?
Yep. This is a jumbo M4 tank from World War II. It was found in the firing range here. There's only a few of them that survived. It's an up-armored tank that was specifically going to be used against the Siegfried Line in World War II. They weren't needed. They weren't used, but only a few survived. We've got one here. And then we go right down the line, the M48, the M60 tanks, and then the M1 tank used in Iraq and Afghanistan today.
Well, what's this big piece of equipment down here?
That's an 8-inch howitzer.
Artillery?
Yep.
And what do we have here?
This is a duster. It's an old tank chassis, and it was modified. They put an anti-aircraft gun on it, but we used to see them in Vietnam firing at ground targets a lot.
Doug, I'm an old Air Force guy, and I see some aircraft over here. I think we should head that direction.
Sure.
So, Doug, over here we have a Vietnam-era chopper.
That's right. We have
recognized that one.
Several Huey helicopters here, various models, and then we have a Cobra gunship, too. And an L-9 observation plane that was actually flown in here. And then moved over and parked on the parked right here.
We're at the Minnesota Military Museum at Camp Ripley up near Little Falls with the curator, Doug Becky. Doug, we're moving inside now. We're going to take a little tour. What are we seeing and where are we headed?
Right. We have a number of galleries. We're starting out here in the Medals and Awards section. These are the uniforms of two Minnesota Medal of Honor winners, Dale Wirenen and Robert Pruden. They were both killed in Vietnam, and their families have donated their uniforms and other things from them. And then over here we have one of two Minnesota Medal of Honor winners, George Mallon. And we're very happy to be able to display all of his award documents. They were rescued from a dumpster in the suburban Twin Cities a few years ago. We had to take everything to a paper conservator and get everything cleaned up. But incredibly important documents, and again, one of only two Minnesota Medal of Honor winners from World War I and almost lost forever. So we're very glad to have these things. And this gallery then takes us through the history of the military in Minnesota. We start out with the earliest, Minnesota's earliest warriors, the Native Americans. And we go through the settlements in Fort Snelling and then get into the Civil War.
So, Doug, these are Civil War artillery pieces?
That's right. They came to Minnesota before the Civil War. They were used during the 1862 Dakota War, actually fired in combat. The carriages are a replacement. They were built by some of the very talented staff here at Camp Ripley many years ago, but the tubes are the original tubes.
And I see we've got some Civil War uniforms here.
That's right. Well, this is the timeline of Minnesota military history.
And I know you've told me this before, but the significance of the red shirts?
Oh, the red shirts, yeah. The Minnesota offered the first volunteer unit into the Civil War. Governor Ramsey was in Washington, D.C. the day war was declared and immediately offered a unit to President Lincoln. And so there was a lot of volunteers coming in, but the supply system couldn't keep up. And so they went down to a lumberjack or a trader supply company in St. Paul and got what they could, which were red or blue lumberjack shirts or trade shirts for the trade with the Indians and black pants. And that's what the men had when they first went off. Some of the men were later issued the blue army uniforms, but when they went to the Battle of Bull Run, the commander said, "No, we want everybody in the same uniform. Put on your red shirts and black pants." And later on, they did get the standard blue uniforms for the whole unit.
Doug, we have to take a short break, and we'll be back at the Minnesota Military Museum at Camp Ripley with the Minnesota Military Radio Hour right here on Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130. Please stay with us. Well, Welcome back to the Minnesota Military Radio Hour. We're up in Camp Ripley at the Minnesota Military Museum with Doug Becky, the curator, and he's giving us a tour inside the museum. So, Doug, we're at the World War I portion of the exhibit. There's some interesting things here, gas mask and some boots. What's the significance of these boots?
Right. Well, those are hobnails on the bottom of the boots, metal nails that were nailed into the leather. And they go back to at least Roman times. They found Roman sandals with hobnails on them. The point was to A, give traction, and B, protect the leather and give longevity to the leather on the soles. Of course, we're coming up on the 100th anniversary of World War I. Started in 1914, America got involved in 1917. So we're going to be building our big 100th anniversary of World War I exhibit here. And of course, World War I was the period when the modern military really took shape. If you think about the Air Corps, really got started then, became the Air Force. All the unit designations that we still have today were created in World War I in 1917. The Minnesota units that went off to World War I no longer had the designations that they had in the Civil War. They had the modern designations that they've got today, and that all came about through World War I.
In the trench warfare, I see gas masks everywhere. That was a big part of the...
Oh, yeah,
the
huge deal. It was a gruesome business in World War I, terrible war. And we think about the casualties that we've had in Iraq and Afghanistan, and of course each one is a tragedy, but 9 years in Iraq and there's 4,000 killed, I think, but in World War I you could lose 4,000 killed in an hour. Just incredible carnage.
So Doug, we're moving into the World War II exhibit, and I see here a mannequin set up as a United States Marine in the Pacific.
That's right. Well, again, we honor all Minnesota veterans, all branches of the service and all eras, so the Marines, Navy, Air Force. We just did a special exhibit on the Merchant Marine. And, of course, Minnesota had very significant participation in World War II, not just through the National Guard, but members in all the branches of the service. And so we seek to honor all of them.
And it looks like you've got German weapons, you've got some Japanese caps, you've got a German helmet.
That's right.
A lot of trophies of war, looks like.
A lot of trophies of war. Americans were great souvenir hunters, and a lot of Americans brought things back. And, of course, it adds depth to the collection when we can display things from other countries, both allies and the people we fought against.
So, Doug, we're in a special room here. It's the story of the 34th Infantry Division from 1917 to today. Can you tell us about it?
Well, the 34th Infantry Division is the inheritor of the Minnesota units that go back to the Civil War. And the division was formed in 1917 out of units from Minnesota, the Dakotas, Iowa, and I think a unit from Nebraska, too. And but the headquarters is now in Minnesota. And they were formed at Camp Deming, New Mexico. And the first name for the unit, nickname, was the Sandstorm Division because they were formed in the desert. But it's now the Red Bull Division, and that changed in before World War II. They saw a lot of combat in World War II. First unit sent overseas, one of the very first units into combat in North Africa. Some of their units were participated in the initial landing in Italy, fought all the way through the Italian campaign and had a very distinguished record of combat. And they now have a great record as a National Guard unit. I think they have one of the highest readiness ratings in the nation for any National Guard unit. And they have a lot to be proud of.
Are these original uniforms that you've collected here?
Right. These are all original uniforms. Some of them have real stories. For example, here's a World War I uniform in this case. And that was worn by a man named Brisley. And over here on the other side of the room, we have the story of his son who served in the 34th Division in World War II. So there's a lot of family connections here. And all through the room, you find a face, a story, and then an artifact that goes with it. So these are real people. These are real Minnesotans who did things and served. And it's a nice experience for me when I can stand in this room and see a World War II veteran coming in with his grandson or great-grandson or granddaughter, and they're pointing themselves out. They see, that's me, or that's where I was, or this is my unit. Some of these things have some real Minnesota histories. They were things that were really there. The German helmet here, captured at Monte Cassino, and inside in the lining it says, "To Gary from Dad, captured at Hill 460, 500 meters from Abbey Monte Casino. Dad sent it home to the son, and here it is here. Something that was really there.
Doug, now we're walking into an exhibit for the Minnesota's two Civil Wars, 1861 to 1866. Can you explain that to me?
Well, the Civil War was an extremely traumatic event in the nation's history. Minnesota was a new state. It was only founded in 1858. And in 1861, when the war started, Minnesota offered the first regiment of volunteers to the president. That became the 1st Minnesota Infantry Regiment, now the 135th Infantry Regiment. And Minnesota eventually sent 11 volunteer units off to the war. But what many Minnesotans aren't aware of is that we actually had two civil wars. One was right here in the state. That was the 1862 Dakota War. The Dakota had, through a series of treaties, had been selling off a lot of their land. And settlers were moving into the state and encroaching on Dakota territories. And finally, in 1862, a war erupted. And more Minnesotans died in the 1862 Dakota War than died in the war with the South. So it was a very bloody affair, a tragic affair, and the after effects are still with us today. There's still hard feelings from it. And we try to recognize that war and talk about it in this exhibit.
I'll bet if that question was on a history exam, most people in Minnesota would fail.
Well, I have to confess that it was only last year that I, a lifelong Minnesota resident, went out to western Minnesota and visited some of the sites of that battlefield. Did it for the first time just a year ago.
And once again, in this exhibit room, you've got actual uniforms, a lot of photos, pictures of Minnesotans from the time.
That's right. We try to focus on the people who served. So there you get a face, a story, and hopefully an artifact that will go with it.
Doug, we've taken a rather short tour of the museum, and it's taken us a while. How many hours would you have to spend here to get a full belly full of it?
Well, I've gone to museums all my life, and I found that it's good in short bursts. So come many times, spend a little time, look at this, look at that. Come back, get an overview of the whole thing, and then come back and just focus on a certain area. Focus on World War I, focus on World War II, focus on the Civil War. And we're open 7 days a week from May 1st to October 1st, from 10 to 5. And this time of year, it gets pretty cold up here in the winter, but we're open from on Thursdays and Fridays from 9 to 4. And the public's welcome. We're on the National Guard base, but just tell them at the gate you're coming to the museum, and you're more than welcome to come here.
And is there a website where they can find more information?
Yes, just look under Minnesota Museum, MN Museum, and it will come up.
And Doug, one final question. How can our listeners and viewers help the Minnesota Military Museum? Are you still collecting up more items, and do you need some funds?
Absolutely. We're always looking for financial support. Every nonprofit organization needs that kind of help. But to document the service of Minnesotans, we're looking for stories, we're looking for artifacts. Preferably they come together, that it's not always enough just to get an artifact. It's nice to get the story. So when we display it, we can again do the face, the story, and the artifact, and they all tie together, and it gives a human face to history.
Not just items from various periods, but it's actual Minnesotans and a story and artifacts, and it's brilliantly displayed.
Yep.
And it looks like you need more room, Doug.
That's right, we do.
Doug, I'd like to thank you for the tour of the Minnesota Military Museum.
Thank you
Camp
for coming.
Camp Ripley up in Little Falls.
Let's visit this week's Support Our Troops Showcase and discuss how the Theater of War project is spurring conversation about the challenges of deployment. Since 2008, Theater of War has presented more than 160 readings of Sophocles' story of Ajax. The story has been told to countless audience members, both military and civilian. These ancient plays timelessly and universally depict the psychological and physical wounds inflicted upon warriors by war and separation. Theater of War is coming to the Twin Cities for the first time with two presentations. Attend Theater of War on November 28th at the Rosemount Armory and Community Center, or on December 5th at the Minneapolis Community and Technical College. Those that have experienced Theater of War have said it's a powerful and thought-provoking night. The two-hour experience includes a performance in which audiences ultimately share in the suicide of the great warrior Ajax as seen through the eyes of his wife, son, brother, and military comrades. Next, a specially chosen panel comments on what they saw. Finally, the audience shares in a town hall discussion and share experiences and solutions on dealing with present-day deployment issues. Theater of War is being presented thanks to 10,000 Things Theater Company, For complete ticket information, visit 10,000things.org. Thank you, 10,000 Things, for bringing such a unique opportunity to our Beyond the Yellow Ribbon communities. Beyond the Yellow Ribbon is a comprehensive program that creates awareness for the purpose of connecting service members and their families with community support, training, services, and resources. To learn how you can highlight what you're doing for military families, contact us at beyondtheyellowribbon.org. Beyond the Yellow Ribbon, united to bring service members all the way home. Coming up next, we'll interview the author of Counterstrike, the untold story of America's secret campaign against Al-Qaeda. That's right here on the Minnesota Military Radio Hour on Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130. Welcome back to the Minnesota Military Radio Hour. I'm your host, Tom Lyons. It's now time for the Commissioner's Corner, a message from the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. Now here's Larry Shelado.
The Minnesota Veterans Home in Minneapolis is competing in a Home Depot Foundation contest to win $25,000. This money will benefit residents at the home, our nation's heroes. If our home wins the competition, it also enters us in a grand prize competition for $250,000. Right now, we are in second place, and there are only a few more days left to vote until the end of November. To learn more or to cast your vote, visit the Minnesota Military Radio Hour Facebook page.
Thank you, Commissioner Shelado. Joining us now is Eric Schmidt, a senior writer who covers terrorism and national security issues for the New York Times. He is also the author of Counterstrike, the untold story of America's secret campaign against Al-Qaeda. Mr. Schmidt, welcome to the Minnesota Military Radio Hour.
Thank you very much for having me this afternoon.
Eric, I understand you have a Minneapolis connection.
That's right. I was actually born in Eden Prairie and grew up there as a kid. Moved away to the San Francisco Bay Area when I was just seven, but still have plenty of aunts and uncles and cousins, and actually have a great-grandmother who built a cabin up on the North Shore near Two Harbors that we still go back to every few years.
Well, it's great that you get a chance to come back. I hope you pick the good weather months to do so.
Thank you.
So I understand that you've covered the Pentagon and terrorism for many years. Can you tell us a little bit about your career?
Yes, I started with the Times about almost 30 years ago as a news assistant with one of the New York Times columnists here in Washington. Then worked my way up through the city desk in New York and the business desk there. But really for the last more than 20 years, I've been in Washington, D.C., covering national security, including the military, as well as a short stint in the late 90s covering politics and Congress. Most recently, I've been covering terrorism, which is kind of a combination of beats here, law enforcement, military, and others, but really focusing on Al-Qaeda and its various affiliates around the world and the terrorism threat that it poses to the United States and American interests abroad.
So the last 10 years, you've been a little busy with that.
It certainly has. Since 9/11, I've been very busy. Spent more than a dozen reporting trips to Iraq and Afghanistan, and more recently, four different trips into Pakistan, as well as reporting projects in Northern Africa, the Philippines, and the Middle East for terrorism stories for the New York Times.
How safe are those trips into Pakistan?
It's gotten increasingly riskier as the anti-Americanism in Pakistan increases over the last several years. I think at this point, to go into Pakistan, it's still a little bit risky for American journalists to do that. Certainly, once you get outside the capital of Islamabad, and I've been fortunate to travel up in Peshawar near the Afghan-Pakistan border, I think there it gets obviously, as you approach that area in the tribal areas where the main Al-Qaeda leadership is still, the remaining leadership is still there, as well as some of the fighters, it gets even dicier.
We've spent a lot of time and money in the last 10 years working on counterterrorism and so forth. What do you think we have to show for it?
Well, I think what's happened is, of course, over the past decade, the American government has learned a lot. I think on 9/11 itself, there were very few people in the United States government who knew much about Al-Qaeda, much less other terrorist organizations. And the government really wasn't trained and equipped to fight terrorists as networks. I think the initial impulse, perhaps understandably, was to treat them as a traditional enemy, and as you perhaps the idea that you could kill and capture your way to victory by killing enough militants on the ground, capturing their leaders, the organization would collapse from within. Al-Qaeda has proved to be much more resilient than that. Its ideology has proved to be much more resilient than that. And I think it's taken almost a decade, really, to get a better, though still imperfect, understanding of Al-Qaeda and how it operates from an intelligence standpoint. And the approach that the United States, working with its allies overseas, has also changed. Now you have what we call in our book, Counterstrike, a much more holistic type of approach, where it's not just the military and the intelligence communities, which still play, obviously, a very important role, as we saw with the Navy SEAL raid on bin Laden's house in Pakistan in May. But you have other government agencies, such as the State Department, its diplomats, the FBI, the Treasury Department, playing much more important roles, not just here in Washington at the policy level, but sending analysts and agents into the field, working with their counterparts overseas to combat the legal aspects of terrorism, as well as the financing that supports terrorist networks. So I think, it's still, the end, the American government, its counterterrorism campaign has succeeded essentially in pushing the threat down the road, hopefully pushing the severity of what we believe will be another, ultimately will be another attack against the United States, but hopefully lessened the severity of that attack when it happens.
We're speaking with Eric Schmidt, senior writer from the New York Times and author of Counterstrike, on the Minnesota Military Radio Hour here on Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130. Eric, we read a lot these days. Clearly, we're pulling out of Iraq, but every day it seems like in the paper we're reading about Afghanistan and Pakistan and the United States and their relationship. Are they coordinating their anti-terrorism efforts, or are they at odds with each other?
This is in Afghanistan and Pakistan?
Yes.
Yeah, right now it's a kind of a problematic relationship that you have between the two countries, even though President Karzai of Afghanistan just recently visited Pakistan and pledged support for the activities there. You have tensions right now that the United States is trying to bridge, obviously, because the U.S. has just under 100,000 troops remaining in Afghanistan and fighting many militants, the Taliban in the southern part of Afghanistan, and other groups such as the Akhani Network in eastern Afghanistan. Problem is, of course, that many of these organizations still have safe havens across the border in Pakistan. And it's certainly been a problematic part, and one of the most vexing problems that the U.S. government faces in its foreign policy is trying to convince Pakistan to do more. Now, to be sure, Pakistan has done a fair amount in the last decade, particularly in the early years of the decade, very important in helping capture some of the top al-Qaeda operatives in some of the Pakistani cities. In recent years, despite the deployment of some 100,000 or more Pakistani forces along the Pakistan border, there have been a number of terrorist attacks that have still come out of the tribal areas. And, of course, the U.S. government has accused the Pakistanis of supporting the Taliban and some other networks that operate in Afghanistan, essentially as proxies for them. This gets into the very complicated relationship that Pakistan has with India, and how Pakistan in many ways fears that they will be encircled not only by India on its east, by a pro-India Afghanistan on the west. And so they have supported terrorist groups such as the Taliban to carry out attacks against allied troops in Afghanistan now, to try and establish themselves for the long term. When the United States ultimately leaves Afghanistan, Pakistan does not feel it's encircled on both sides of its borders.
Eric, we have to take a short break. When we come back, I want to talk about your book, Counterstrike, The Untold Story of America's Secret Campaign Against Al-Qaeda, which focuses on the various military and civilian agency responses to terrorism. This is the Minnesota Military Radio Hour on Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130. Please stay with us. Welcome back to the Minnesota Military Radio Hour. I'm your host, Tom Lyons. We're talking with Eric Schmidt, who's a senior writer, covers terrorism and national security issues for the New York Times, and the author of Counterstrike. Eric, you've written this book, Counterstrike, The Untold Story of America's Secret Campaign Against Al-Qaeda. Can you tell us what prompted you to write it and what's it about?
Yes, I wrote it with my New York Times colleague, Tom Shanker, who I'd been working with for many of the last 10 years as military correspondent for the New York Times. And what we were really struck by when we started this project in early 2008 was how much the counterterrorism campaign had changed from the early days. I think I mentioned a little bit about how a little the U.S. government really knew about terrorism, and the approach was fairly narrow. And to the point now where the U.S. has evolved to understanding terrorist networks much better and basically attacking terrorist networks with a much more holistic approach, using the military and intelligence, of course, but also different agencies such as the FBI, Treasury Department, and State Department. What we also talk about in our book is that there's a new way of thinking about terrorism and how elements, thinkers in the Pentagon have been able to come up with strategies that adapt practices of the Cold War deterrence, that is, the deterrence that kept the very tense peace between the U.S. and Soviet Union, how they're able to basically adapt principles from that to apply toward terrorists. For instance, the whole idea that terrorists actually value things. Well, they may not value physical things like the Kremlin or military bases as the Soviet Union did. They honor their prestige, their honor. They value these kind of things. And if you can target that and undermine that, undermine the credibility of terrorist leaders, terrorist networks, you can oftentimes sow distrust and confusion within terrorist networks almost as effectively as going after them on the ground. So it's a combination of effects that we talk about in our book, both the effects of the very able special operations and conventional forces in places like Afghanistan and Iraq, but it's also using different ways of getting inside terrorist networks, including in cyberspace, which is one of the areas where terrorists both recruit, raise money, and even plan operations. We write about in our book how U.S. analysts have been able to get inside these networks, hack into terrorist cell leaders' cell phones, send out confusing and contradictory messages. Basically, Arabic-speaking analysts are able to pose as informants and get outside of jihadi chat rooms. And again, pose many provocative questions that lead some potential recruits to turn away from terrorism. So it's a much, it's in the evolution that's taken place over the last 10 years. While it's still imperfect, and the U.S. is still having to deal with a rapidly evolving and morphing enemy out there, the U.S. government, working with its allies overseas, has come up with much smarter approaches to combating terrorism.
In your opinion, are we at a pivotal point for al-Qaeda?
I think we are. What's happened clearly with the death of bin Laden in May is it kind of puts a punctuation mark on the diminishing impact that the core al-Qaeda leadership in Pakistan has right now. Its ability to plan and carry out attacks in the U.S. has been greatly lessened. The problem is that al-Qaeda is kind of a corporate model. It's developed franchises in places like North Africa, Somalia, and the most dangerous one of all in Yemen. That was the affiliate that planted the so-called underpants bomber, a young man who tried to blow himself up on a plane in Christmas of 2009. Same organization tried to blow up a couple of cargo planes by packing explosive onto printer cartridges. So while I think al-Qaeda is now pursuing a dual strategy, there are still elements that are trying to obtain weapons of mass destruction, but more likely these smaller affiliates will try and carry out smaller-scale attacks that can still have not only a devastating impact on individuals and on cities, but may well have dramatic economic impact as well.
Eric, we just got about a minute left. I understand that just before you published your book, bin Laden was killed. How did you get that story so quickly?
Yeah, we were very fortunate in the sense that we literally were in the final stages of editing. We're a few days away from sending the book off to the bindery when bin Laden was killed. Our editor basically said, I'll give you 96 hours to rewrite the beginning, rewrite the end, and give me a 5,000-word chapter on the raid itself and how the rest of the book relates to it. So we're basically able to get the death of bin Laden and some of its impact into the book right at the last minute.
So no sleep for you the last few days?
Excuse me?
No sleep for you the last few days?
No, absolutely not, Tom. It was quite a last rush those last 4 or 5 days.
And where can our listeners find the book?
If you go to our website, www.counterstrikethebook.com, you'll find out more information about the book, about the authors, and ways to order the book online.
All right, great. Thanks for joining us today, Eric.
Thank you very much, Tom. Appreciate being on.
That was Eric Schmidt, He's a senior writer who covers terrorism and national security issues for the New York Times and author of Counterstrike, the Untold Story of America's Secret Campaign Against Al-Qaeda on the Minnesota Military Radio Hour. We're just about out of time. Thanks for listening to this edition of the Minnesota Military Radio Hour. I'd like to thank our guests for joining us this week, Doug Becky from the Minnesota Military Museum and Eric Schmidt. And as always, we're happy to have our weekly messages from the Commissioner, Larry Shalladeau, the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, and the Adjutant General, Major General Rick Nash. Please join us next week as we talk about Pearl Harbor and interview an Afghanistan war veteran. That's next Sunday morning at 7 right here on Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130. I'm Tom Lyons, and I hope that you make a difference in someone's life this week.
You've been listening to the Minnesota Military Radio Hour with host Tom Lyons. Tom is the founder and owner of Phalon Partners Limited, a merger and acquisition advisory firm located in Minneapolis. He's also a Vietnam veteran of the United States Air Force. We hope you found this program to be informative and entertaining. This has been a production of Clear Channel, MinnesotaMilitaryRadioHour.com, the Minnesota National Guard, BeyondTheYellowRibbon.org, and the Minnesota Department of Veteran Affairs. Podcasts of this program are available at MinnesotaMilitaryRadioHour.com. Thanks for listening.